I'm John Krall. The digital revolution has changed the way people read. Sales of ebooks now challenge or surpass those of traditional paper and ink books. A revolution in the way people read means a revolution for libraries, too. On No Limits today, we're going to talk about how the electronic age is altering those treasured vaults of information, entertainment, and knowledge, our libraries, with our guests, new Indianapolis Marion County Public Library CEO Jackie Nitas, Ben Davis University High School Library Media Specialist Jessica Siglin, and Joel Silver, Associate Director and Curator of Books at Indiana University's Lilly Library. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits and Happy New Year. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and the executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. We are talking today about the electronic age of libraries, really about the revolution in reading and libraries. We're fortunate to have as our guests Jackie Nitas, the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library's new CEO. Jackie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for being here.
It's good to have you here. Jessica Siglin, who is a library media specialist at Ben Davis University High School. That is a mouthful of a title.
It
Jessica,
is.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. And joining us on the phone from Bloomington is Joel Silver, who is the Associate Director and Curator of Books for the Lilly Library at IU. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. Well, I want to talk a little bit. We'll start broad and then focus things down. I mean, do we all agree that we are in a revolution right now when it comes to reading and storing material? Jackie, you're nodding your head. Jackie, you need
with a capital R.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, talk about some of the changes and challenges then that you're facing right now.
Well, the rapidity of the change, if we can have another R here,
sure.
I think is really the thing that's extremely challenging to us. We can all know it's going on, but shifting gears and being able to adjust our facilities, our staff, our buying patterns, all of those kinds of our policies to a whole new world of publishing, the electronic publishing industry, is really a fascinating challenge for us.
And could you talk a little bit about specifically how those things
sure,
work?
Sure. I think that...
What choices or changes have
right,
you had to make?
Traditionally, libraries knew all the models for pricing materials, and we had relationships for how to buy them, and we knew what worked, and we had plans. And it was a pretty stable world for a long time. And now we are entering a new era where the electronic publishing industry itself is still trying to decide what its pricing models are, what its relationships with authors are, how does copyright play into any of this, and something as simple as the ability of a publisher to make an electronic item evaporate after a certain number of checkouts. That didn't happen with the paper book.
Yeah, once you bought it, you had it forever.
We had it until
until it fell apart.
Right, yeah. Or until no one wanted it anymore, and then we checked to see if Joel wanted it. And but you know, in the electronic world, all bets are off. This is all different, and we're racing to learn it all and to figure out how to deploy it in a community.
Jessica, how has it changed what you do?
I think I look at purchasing differently. Mm-hmm. I'm deciding not to purchase nonfiction as much. I use my databases a lot more. And I also have to think about those challenges in filling the digital gap with my students. Some students don't have access to tablets or to smartphones or even to the internet. And how do I get these digital resources in their hands? It is definitely catching with students. They are willing to use the electronic sources, but how do I get that in their hands and how do I get them access is where my challenges are.
Well, and Joel, in some ways, I think you bring kind of an ironic, one of the ways I first encountered you was I read your column in the magazine Fine Books and Collections.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed now that that's basically an online publication, which sort of illustrates the change in and of itself.
Well, actually, it's gone back to print. It's now a quarterly as well.
Yes, and I get that, but I also, I just saw yesterday the monthly update. And,
right.
And that's what the most frequent contact with readers is now. But it illustrates because it was, what, six times a year?
Yes, it was.
And now, you know, that a lot of it, the discussion is really about what this is going to do to the book and the idea of these great book collections that have been maintained through decades and centuries. Do you feel some pressure there?
Well, there's always been pressure on libraries. Among the challenges, in addition to the ones that have already been mentioned, among the challenges for all kinds of libraries is that libraries have traditionally been underfunded and understaffed, and whenever something new comes in, like digital materials in this case, libraries are asked to add those to the large group of existing things they're already doing with a fairly limited budget. And at the same time, there are still many, many people who are interested in traditional physical printed books and will be for quite a long time. So libraries are having to face dealing with both of those. And in terms of maintaining collections, the physical books do bring something else that the digital books can't. Reading a physical book is quite a different experience than reading an electronic version of a text or an illustrated text. And many of the people who use the Lilly Library, which is devoted to acquiring, preserving, and making available books and manuscripts in their original physical forms, are interested not only in the texts and illustrations of the books that they're reading at the Lilly, but interested in other aspects of it, notes made by an individual reader in the margins, the bindings of books, the paper on which the book was printed, all sorts of things that don't reproduce at all in the electronic version. So these things will be around for quite some time, and even though the electronic book is becoming much more popular than it previously was, and certainly in the world of journalism, the electronic information has taken over a lot of roles that print had before. But in terms of books, there are still a large number of books being produced and a number of book collections that continue to be formed.
Well, and I would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to pick up on a point, actually, that Jessica made when you said that you were changing your buying patterns in regard to nonfiction. Are there mm-hmm. certain parts of collections that are more affected by this change than others? Jessica, I'll start with you. Why, you mentioned nonfiction because it's more easily searchable. Is it that readers also have a different feeling about a novel, that they want to hold it in their hands and have that more tactical experience?
When I listen to my students, a lot of them do want to have that physical book in their hand in terms of leisure reading. But when I am teaching research skills, we are apt to go to the databases because there's so much available in databases, and it is updated constantly. Whereas in nonfiction books, they go out of date so much, and so it is not cost effective for me to purchase those nonfiction books. At Ben Davis University High School, we have majors, and for instance, my IT majors, all of those books that I have to help them and to supplement them in their studies are outdating so fast that for me, it is just more cost effective to go with databases or electronic resources.
Joel, I want to ask real quickly about the notion. Do you think the electronic age is going to change the value of antiquarian books, or increase it, decrease it?
Well, excuse me. I think that as more and more books come out only in electronic form, then the books themselves, the physical books themselves, will be seen as a little more unusual and more precious than they were before. They won't be seen as much eventually as the kind of everyday objects they are now. And in other areas, when that has happened, other areas of collecting, when things are not as familiar to current people, you know, people looking for them in the marketplace, when they're things they don't encounter every day, then the value of them goes up rather than down.
We are talking about libraries and the challenges they face in this electronic age. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. I'm Chris from Indianapolis, and I take art classes with your wife as well at the Art Center.
Oh, you do? All right. It is a small city.
Yeah. Your commenter would probably agree with me. I am concerned about the ephemeral nature of electronic storage, as I've heard on NPR programs before. For instance, those old 3.5-inch floppy disks, nobody knows now, seems to be able to know how to open them even and access data. And so my fear is that with the absence of papyrus or paper printed words, that someday it will be very difficult to understand our history and our development, our culture of this time. We won't be able to go and look at our data right now if it's not printed somehow, because we will have lost the ability to access that digital stuff. Thanks.
Who would like to take a stab at that first? Is that a fear, Jackie Nitas?
Well, I think it is a fear, and things are changing so rapidly that sometimes in our excitement to get the next new technology, we do not pause and think about that. It's actually something that the state has had to think about in terms of public records retention and the notion of, you know, how do you retain public records? So many things are being kept electronically, but at the end of the day, is that going to work 50 or 60 years from now? And the state's very focused on making sure we all microfilm everything, because at least we have found that microfilmed records seem to still have some longevity. But there's a struggle, a constant struggle, about will we be able to use the formats we're creating? Many of us, I think even today, don't have a VHS tape player in our house anymore.
Mm-mm.
And yet, I know I have some VHS tapes that are precious to me, and I don't know if I have a way to play them.
Yeah. Well, and I know that's one of the points. I remember being in a previous life privy to a conversation between Kurt Vonnegut, the writer, and Scott Jones, where Scott Jones was trying to make an argument for the portable handheld device and its ability. And Kurt's response was, well, I have a notebook and I have a pen, and the notebook and the pen never crash. You know, I never lose everything when there's a power surge or anything like that. So, you know, that there is something to be said for this old technology. Do you worry? I mean, obviously, space is limited. You can't keep copies of everything, I presume. Joel, do you worry? I mean, how do you go through making a determination about what should go and what should stay?
Well, in the case of the Lilly Library, we're collecting things in our areas of interest, and our collections are fairly large. We have in our library, which is a part of the IU Bloomington Library system, we have about 400,000 books and more than 7.5 million manuscripts. And we do have some things in electronic form as well. And librarians of all kinds are making choices about what they can preserve, what they can keep. What we do is make selections of books that fit in with our collection policy, fit in with the educational requirements and research requirements at IU, and we're also looking to acquire the papers of writers. I mean, we have Kurt Vonnegut's papers.
Mm-hmm.
At the Lilly in Bloomington. And increasingly, we and other special collections libraries are coping with materials received in electronic form. One of the most publicized cases in recent years has been the acquisition by Emory University of the Salman Rushdie archives, which consisted in large part of his computers and hard drives, as well as other materials. And they have spent a long time backing things up, making them safe, making sure that they will be preserved. And this has led to archivists and librarians looking very carefully at how to migrate what they have to different and new platforms to keep them safe.
We are talking about the electronic age of libraries here on No Limits with our guest, Jackie Needus of the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library, Jessica Siglin of Ben Davis University High School, Joel Silver of the Lilly Library in IU Bloomington. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and the executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. We are talking today about the electronic age of libraries with our guest, Jackie Needus, who is the CEO of the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library, Jessica Siglin, who is a library media specialist at Ben Davis University High School, and Joel Silver, who is the associate director and curator of books at the Lilly Library at IU in Bloomington. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Maggie who says, our online public library has online services that make renewing and searching the card catalog easy and swift. These online services are unexpected in a small rural community. Is this, you know, while we're lamenting some of the things that are disappearing, does the fact that this digital revolution opened things up for a lot of people, is that a good thing? Jackie Needus.
It absolutely is a good thing. And while large libraries may still have significant collections, the fact of the matter is that digital access can really provide an opportunity either for folks who are in smaller communities where their library may not have 1.7 million items in its collection, or where they physically can't get there. We had a conversation recently about homebound patrons. Mm-hmm. And for them, the ability to search the catalog and to download items suddenly opens up their world. And they may be homebound, but that doesn't mean that they don't have access. And so the electronic revolution, these new processes, really do have benefits for those populations.
Well, and it sounds like, to some degree, there are opportunities for collaboration here between libraries and all of that. I mean, part of the reason you guys are here is that you all serve different readerships, I hate to say consumers or whatever or all of that, but that's really, really it. You're not doing precisely the same thing. Is that a strength or a weakness right now?
I think it's a strength, and I was thinking about Jessica's comment about the fact that she needs to make choices about her collection. And I believe she can make them with confidence because she knows that in addition to having the digital resources to turn to, she can also send her students to our libraries, mm-hmm. and we'll have some backup for her. We'll have some supplementary materials that she can't collect.
Absolutely, and I have sent my students to IMCPL often for different resources that I can't provide and that I don't have the money to provide them.
And at the end of the day, there are things we're not going to do. We're going to know that people can go to Joel and access some things.
We are talking about the electronic age of libraries here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Joel, this idea of collaboration, I mean, are there times when somebody wants to bring something to your collection that you say it's really not appropriate for us and try to work with another partner, or?
Oh, yes, quite a lot of the time. And we do try to steer people to the appropriate library. If they're bringing us something that is just not within the scope of our collecting, but would it fit in perfectly at another institution, whether it's ISU or another library on the IU campus or another library in Indianapolis, I mean, we've referred people to a lot of other libraries in the state and all over the country. And John, may I just
add
one other thing about what you were talking about just a couple of minutes ago regarding the digital revolution and libraries? This has certainly affected special collections libraries like the Lilly, and one of the most exciting things in special collections today is the ability that libraries have to reach beyond their physical buildings and to make their materials available in digital form online. And the Lilly Library and the IU libraries have done a great deal in digitizing some of their collections, and we collaborate with on a number of different projects with different institutions. And the idea that eventually more and more of this material will be available to anyone online is very exciting, and we're able to reach people we never could before.
Jackie Needus.
Well, I really enjoy that comment, and I'm seeing the public libraries beginning to have a similar experience. We've been involved now in a couple of projects where we are digitizing collections. A recent one is over in the Irvington area, where the Irvington History Collection has been digitized through a joint project that we did in collaboration with IUPUI libraries. And this is creating a wonderful opportunity to make content available to the community that otherwise might have been stuck in a file cabinet in a basement somewhere and lost for all effects and purposes. And now through these digitization processes and projects, we're getting this material in a format that can be accessed across a far wider audience than might have been the case before.
Well, and I want to pick up on this because I think this is fascinating. Joel made the point earlier that there's been a revolution in you know, journalism and media as well that's related to this. And one of the things I think we've lost is someone who reads an awful lot of news now or you know, consumes an awful lot of news online. One of the joys of reading an actual newspaper was similar to one of the joys of going to a bookstore or going to a library, and that was that you would pick it up, not know exactly what you were looking for, and you might be surprised. I mean, I can think of a lot of times that I'd go to the library knowing I just wanted to find something to read, but I didn't know exactly what I was going to look for. I was just going to wander around until I found something that interested me. Some of that, I think, obviously, you know, the way the internet works is that you've got to punch in your search components. Something interesting to read won't bring you anywhere close to what you want. So has that changed the way that people approach the relationship that people have with libraries? Joel, I'll throw that one back to you first.
Well, it certainly has changed the way people view libraries when they can no longer browse the way they once did. Now, in the case of a library like the Lilly, a special collections library, we're a closed-stack library. Mm-hmm. That is, we have most of our books and manuscripts on site in our building, but the visitors to the library can't browse the collections. They rely on our online catalogs, on the card catalogs, which we still have for parts of our collection, and the expertise of the staff. And so we've been dealing with this sort of thing all the time, and we've tried to help people through different tools that we have try to experience the feel of browsing and discovery. And one of the exciting things in a library like ours is that when they do request a book, even if it's a book that is familiar to them, whether it's a modern book or a book from the 17th or 18th century, they may discover when they see the Lilly Library's copy of the book that it differs from the book that they are familiar with, because when you look at these things closely, because of the ownership by different people of books, different bindings, and the way books were printed in the first place, practically every copy of every book is different from every other copy, and there are always discoveries to be made by reading people's notes that they have written, finding bindings that they didn't know about before, finding some bibliographical aspect of a book, then so in a library like ours, even with closed stacks, when people actually examine the books, discoveries take place every day.
Jackie Needis, does it change the relationship with...
Well, there are still browsers. There's still plenty of folks who visit the library and who have that kind of spontaneous sense of discovery. They're looking across the new bookshelf and something piques their interest and that's their find for the day. So that still happens. And there are also, I think this year, somewhere in the range of 2.5 million times people put a specific book on hold that they wanted. And so those people may not, they're not having that browsing experience. They've got a very specific informational or recreational reading need, and they've expressed it, and they've asked us to help them with it. I think one thing that is happening in the electronic world, and I think we'd probably find this in the schools, is that people do need help navigating the electronic world. The databases are pretty powerful. Jessica mentioned databases a few minutes ago, but they're not easily browsable.
Jessica, please.
Well, in terms of the databases, I do have to go into classrooms to teach that skill to my students in terms of the browsability. My students, in reference back to the question, tend to linger among the book stacks and like to look for that book that just catches their eye. I'm getting ready to start an ebook collection, and so it'll be interesting to see how my students choose those books, because I'll be purchasing primarily fiction to start off, and it'll be interesting to see the statistics to compare the two, how often those are checked out versus my actual print books.
Well, and I presume that does that create some barriers in and of itself, you know, with the traditional reading format, the platform, if to use the modern terminology, the book, anyone who can walk through the door and get a library card can access it, right? I mean, you can read it, but even if you have an e-book, the person has to have an e-reader, right? So there's a kind of disqualifier there almost.
And I mentioned that earlier. There is that digital gap, you know, where some of my students don't have that access. They don't have a tablet. They don't have a smartphone. They don't have internet access.
Or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, I do think there's always going to be a need for the print sources. But like I said, it'll be an interesting comparison when I get that collection started.
We are talking about the electronic age of libraries here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to talk a little bit about how this is going to change the way that librarians are trained, too. It's sort of like the same sort of discussion we're having in the world of journalism right now is how do you train journalists with these new demands and new expectations of readers, viewers, audiences. Jackie?
Well, it's a very important issue for us right now, and it's a great opportunity, but a challenge. I have a little anecdote for you about it. Many people got Kindles for Christmas. We know that because the day after Christmas, they started calling us up and asking us how to download to their Kindle, because even though they got some instructions in that Christmas gift package, they didn't get enough to get them through. And so it's been a very big question in all of our locations. And we were presented with quite a challenge because in the beginning, libraries were not able to offer materials for the Kindle in their electronic collections. And then one day...
Why was that?
Well, I think it was that publishing market thing I talked about in the beginning where the folks who were putting those out weren't going to sell to libraries because they thought it was going to limit their sales. And at some point, they must have reached made a marketing decision and said, okay, I guess we'll go to the library market now. And they announced, basically with next to no notice, that they were going to start giving this stuff to libraries. And all of a sudden, we could get their things.
Presuming they weren't giving it, they were selling
it. Right, because we buy a subscription that allows us, or we pay to get an electronic title that we can then loan to you, the reader. And for a while, we couldn't get the titles in a format that could be downloaded to the Kindle. And then one day, we could. Well, all of a sudden our staff had to know how to download to a Kindle. And it's a little different than to some other tablets that our people were using. Mm-hmm. And so we had almost an overnight training challenge that we had to meet. And fortunately, we have a core group of people who are very excited about this kind of stuff and have been able to put together classes to train other employees. And in each of our buildings, they've been able to teach each other that kind of thing. And so we've had to put hundreds of our own staff through some pretty quick exercises to get up to speed on how to help the patrons use this stuff.
How does that change your business model in that, you know, you saw, when you bought the book, you had the book. Now you're talking about a subscription. It's something presumably then that you have to renew over time.
The pricing models are different from different publishers, mm-hmm. and so there are some things that we can buy the rights to, and we will have presumably forever because they're in the public domain, something like that. Others, one publisher has suggested that if we buy a book from them, we can use it for, I believe, 26 circulations, and then we have to buy it again. And that's kind of interesting. You've put it in your card, your catalog, told the world you have it. It reaches circulation 26 and expires. Okay. But we'll figure that out. We can, these, you know.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at is how you figure something like that out, because you would assume to some degree that gives the people you're trying to serve much more control over your costs. I mean, you, with the number of books you had, you could say, okay, this is our budget and that's it, right? Mm-hmm. But with this, it is, you get a title that everyone loves, and frankly, it's not even the same in that once the book's off the shelf and in somebody else's hands, it can't be in another reader's. But with the electronic copies, you could hit that magic 26 number in 2 minutes, right?
Well, except most of the publishers, if you want 26 copies of an electronic book, you pay for 26 copies of an electronic book. You don't buy one copy and 26 people could read it at the same time.
Oh, so you
but
have...
These are the kinds of things the e-publishing industry is sorting through right now. Electronically, you could buy it once and deploy it a whole bunch of places, but that's not the way the publishing industry is going to make any money.
No.
And so these questions of how long do you own it, how many times can you use it before it's theoretically worn out the way a paperback or hardback book would have been, these interesting questions.
We are talking about the electronic age of libraries here on No Limits with our guest, Jackie Needis, who is the CEO of the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library, Jessica Siglin, who is a library media specialist with Ben Davis University High School, Joel Silver, who is the associate director and curator of books at the Lilly Library and IU in Bloomington. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and the executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. We are talking today about the electronic age of libraries. We are fortunate to have as our guest Jackie Needis, the CEO for the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library, Jessica Siglin, who is a library media specialist at Ben Davis University High School. I'm glad I have not tripped over that yet in this program, and Joel Silver, who is the associate director and curator of books the Lilly Library in Bloomington at IU. We have gotten, looks like a Facebook message from a listener named Alice, no, it's a tweet, who has an e-reader and says that the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library has a great library of Kindle books. I use it constantly. Love the convenience. I mean, how many people are making use of that now?
In 2011, it looks like we had 122,000 ebooks checked out. Mm-hmm. That's a 470% increase over the previous year, so it's growing rapidly.
Oh, yeah. My math skills aren't the greatest, but even that one I can process.
And we were fortunate enough towards the end of the year to be able to make a significant investment in the size of that collection, so I think people are going to find that their choices there very exciting in the next few months, because we've really made an investment in that area.
Now, does that mean that that librarians are going to just have to have better technological skills than they've had in the future? Jessica, I'll throw that one back to you.
Oh, I think so. I think that as I look at my colleagues and myself, we have to adapt very quickly to the changing technologies. We are constantly learning what is out there, what is going to engage students, and then we are going out among our staff and teaching them and co-teaching with them and using these technologies in the classroom. So we are constantly having to learn and having to adapt.
And Joel, do you think with the kind of archival library skills that we're talking about, you're going to require, the librarians of the future are going to require more technological training and skills, or will that not change that much?
Well, definitely they will require more technological training and skills. And we've been seeing this over the past, 20, 30, 40 years, and it's just come at an increasing pace. And even in archives and special collections, there's a great deal more emphasis now than there used to be on the ability to interact with various technological materials, programs, hardware. And at the Lilly, we're constantly involved in digitization programs. We're using electronic resources for our cataloging and our reference all the time. And a lot of the antiquarian book market has shifted to online. So mm-hmm. when we buy books for the Lilly, we're making a number of purchases from online dealers as well. But in addition to the technological expertise that will be required, we also have to make sure not to lose the knowledge of books and manuscripts, because a lot of that knowledge really will be kept in special collections in the future. And we're the ones who will have to be explaining historical books and manuscripts to all of our visitors.
Well, and in some ways, we're talking about two different kinds of experience here, too, aren't we? In the particularly, Joel, in your case, the joy of having an antiquarian book is that sense of being connected with a prior era, and not just with a person or persons who wrote it, but all of the people who have encountered it over time. E-books,
that's right.
It's a more solitary experience.
Yes, and there's something magical about holding a book, experiencing it with all of your senses. And at the same time, we recognize that not everybody will be able to come into the Lilly Library to do this. And if they're introduced to these things first, remotely by a digital surrogate, by a digital image of the book online, then this is something that we have to try to do. And that will increase the chances that they will want to come in to our library or to another library where they can experience the one-to-one interaction with a real book or manuscript.
We are talking about the electronic age of libraries here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Jeb, welcome to the program.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Doing fine. Your question.
I think about this a lot since I run a music archive, and one of the things that I've considered is security through ubiquity, having as many digital copies available on as many computers around the world as you can. And I just wondered if your panel could address that idea of just making digital information as available as possible, so that essentially you're crowdsourcing the security of it going forward in terms of it being retained.
Good question. Thanks for the call. Well, Jackie, You were shaking your head up and down and sort of back and forth at the same time.
Well, I think the caller really does remind us of what a village we are at the end of the day. And we can say all we want about, you know, there should be one copy of everything at the Library of Congress. But at the end of the day, if all of us are keeping some part of the human record, and we all keep talking to each other, hopefully it'll all get retained. And there is something to be said for backups, if you will, or a redundancy in the long haul. And I think that's a little bit of what he's talking about, in the hope that if everybody's keeping some stuff at the end of the day, we can all find something somewhere from each other.
But to some degree, I would think the other challenge is going to be then with that approach is, how do we know who's got what? Yeah, you know, if I want to read that.
Well, librarians worry about that every day. Yeah. In fact, we go online to each other's catalogs to find out what we have, and we go into large national networked catalogs to try to figure out what we can borrow from each other for our patrons so that we're not all having to have all of it. And I think the caller is really asking a kind of a big global question, probably far beyond what some of us locally deal with. But I do think we try really hard to connect with each other and share resources so that we don't all have to have it.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Sandy. It said, as the need for book stacks decrease with more electronic resources, what is the impact on future planning for the physical design and programming for libraries? Jessica, do you think it's going to alter?
You know, I don't. I look at my library, and I've talked about my nonfiction collection and weeding that and going more towards a digital ebook collection with my nonfiction collection. I don't think that there's necessarily going to be a decrease in a stack because, like we've talked about, there's that digital gap, and we need to fill that. And some people just don't have access, and so we're going to need to always have that print source available. I don't know. Jackie, what do you think?
Well, we have a range of users, and so we do have a range of ways in which they want to find their information, but we are examining exactly this question right now in all of our facilities across the county. And I think patrons will see, over time, a shift in the proportion of space that is used to store and display print materials, and the assignment of more space to either computers or places where people can access electronic information. Because what we're finding is they're accessing it not just on our computers, but they're accessing it by bringing in their own laptops, bringing in their own tablets. They're coming to us because they know that they can find a warm, safe, pleasant place to do whatever intellectual pursuit they're about. They know we're going to have high-speed internet and good bandwidth, and so they're going to be able to have a successful experience of accessing information. It's just not going to come out of our books.
Well, and yeah, you now have a place, almost a lounge, where people can sit and read with, get a cup of coffee or a soda or something.
A lounge or a laboratory of some sort for them, yeah. Mm.
We are talking about the electronic age of libraries here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. John, welcome to the program. John?
Oh, hello there.
Hi. Welcome to the program. Your question, please.
I've got a question about essays and pre-published materials that may have been created by an author before they went big and got published. Are there any initiatives in the works to kind of collect some of these materials that may have previously been lost to history because there weren't any copies of them, such as school essays or materials that have never been published?
Good question, John. Joel, that one would seem to be pitched more to you than anyone else. How much of the interest in terms of collecting antiquarian materials and really building a collection about a famous writer is focused on the stuff that hasn't been published or was even apprentice work?
Oh, a great deal of it is, certainly. And a lot of the ability to collect that and keep it depends on what has been saved in the first place. If the manuscripts were kept, and many writers do keep everything that they write, and as long as their families have not gotten rid of it at some point, then those are the kinds of things that are of great interest to researchers, and libraries like the Lilly certainly are very anxious to add those things to the collections. But if the manuscripts were destroyed, then there isn't much that can be done in that regard. So it's just an awareness of what is worth keeping and what is not.
Well, and that is, how persistent a problem is that? I mean, we're talking about two different impulses. As frankly, as a guy who's made his living with his pen for a lot of years, there are some things, frankly, I would not want anyone else to read that I'd like to disavow. And yet, I can see how, if I were a much more important writer, if I were Kurt Vonnegut or somebody like that, you wanted to track the development of what is a genuinely great talent, that stuff is of value. Do you run into that frequently, where writers are trying to in effect, erase their footsteps in the sand?
Oh, yeah. Certainly writers or writers' families, and there are a lot of famous instances in literary history of these things. And it is an individual decision. As a writer, your manuscripts are your manuscripts, and you're free to keep what you want and not keep what you don't want. And so it all depends on, you know, how your decisions have changed over time and what it is you're looking at with what you have left, really.
We are talking about the electronic age of libraries here on No Limits. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine. Your question, please.
Just a comment and a question about a discussion a little earlier. The caller talking about storage technology and retrofitting and preparing to be able to handle old storage technology. And I guess I'm a little bit more of an optimist when it comes to technology. I tend to see that we're moving, I think, a little more towards technology that allows us to incorporate those things a little easier. And I guess my question would be, you know, in terms of how libraries over the decades and years have kind of diversified in terms of their offerings, how do libraries kind of figure into the ability for people to maybe convert or archive things of that nature? Is there any kind of movement in that way for the libraries right now?
Jackie Needus, good question. Thank you, Paul.
I have seen some libraries described in the literature who are adding laboratories, if you will, to their offerings so that people who want the ability to convert or digitize items have the potential to literally come into the library and use library facilities to do that kind of transformation. Now, obviously, there are for-profit companies out there that can do that for you, too. And we face, again, questions of the digital divide and people's ability to afford some of those kinds of services. But I have seen that as an offering in libraries in some other cities.
We have gotten question from a listener named Ron. Says the cutbacks at the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library are really hurting poor people who don't have computers. In the past, librarians were guardians of material and information. What can libraries do to ensure that electronic sources are good sources? Librarians used to provide that service. Some ways it's a similar question to what we're having in the journalism world, too, is that role of who's going to play the gatekeeper right now, who's going to vet or verify that this is accurate. Jackie, that's probably, since it came to you, is...
Well, it's a challenge for librarians, because librarians don't want to see themselves as policing people's access to materials. We've always been strong believers in intellectual freedom and things like that. But we've also seen our role as one of helping the public know that the materials they were accessing were quality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we made book selection decisions over the decades, we made them in part because of a belief that we were choosing materials that our users could count on, could trust, could believe were well vetted or were reviewed and things like that, so that they knew they were getting materials they could trust. And that becomes more difficult in an electronic world because, frankly, it can be difficult to know where stuff came from on the internet. And I think librarians in their training now are learning new skills about that. They need to have a better understanding of who is publishing what on the internet and need to be available to provide some guidance to our users about the sources that they're looking at electronically. But it is harder than it ever was.
Well, and I would think, is there ever a day when we're not, and we've only got about 20 seconds to answer this question, which may be the biggest one, is there ever going to be a day when we don't have sort of traditional bricks and mortar stacks of books libraries? Jackie Needus.
Ever going to be a day? You know, we've all seen movies in which that happens. Look at Tron. You know, there's a little shelf of books in there, and it's kind of like an odd moment. But I think that it is going to be a long, long time before we become one format. We're going to have a long time with a wide range of formats out there for people, and libraries are going to be the place where they're going to find that mixture.
We have run out of time, but I want to thank all of you. I really would like to have you all back sometime so we can continue this conversation because I think it's fascinating. I'd like to thank my guests, Jackie Needus of the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library. Jackie, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Appreciate it.
Jessica Siglin of Ben Davis University High School. Jessica, it was good to have you here.
Thank you.
And Joel, it was a pleasure talking with you, Joel Silver of the Lilly Library at IU.
Thank you for having me.
We will be back next week when we talk about Indy at the Crossroads. Please join us. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. We'll talk with you next week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alsip. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.